Welcome to the Dynasty Guru Podcast, Episode 11. I'm Tom Trudeau, joined by Tyler Baber and Ben Diamond. Guys, it's the May 4th Everybody Panic edition of this podcast. We're going to focus on some names, some guys that are off to hot starts, some guys that we're freaking out about, maybe talk about some of the panic trades we've seen or made, and then also maybe talk about if there's a name perhaps in the minor leagues that is catching our eye in the early goings. So we'll start with Babe Ruth himself. All rise. I hope you're standing because we're going to talk about Aaron Judge. First of all, we'll talk about the man, the myth, the legend himself, and then let's kind of use him as a way to looking back in hindsight, if there's any way we can learn from the Aaron Judge story about being in on him early next time. So first, Ben, you like myself, you're a big Yankees fan. What have you seen from him in the early going that gives you the optimism that this is real?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not expecting him to go out and hit 75 home runs this year, which I think he might be on track for, but a lot of this is totally real. And I mean, it's not shocking when you just look at him and see that 6-7 frame that, I mean, the 80 power, the obviously elite power is all there. And just he's breaking Statcast one game at a time. And I think that is pretty good indication that all of those home runs are for real. I mean, if he's going to continue making contact, he's not going to keep hitting at a 330 average. He'll probably, strikeouts are going to stay around the 25% mark, but I mean, those home runs are real. So maybe he's going to be more of a one trick pony than he is right now. But I mean, you're still seeing, I think, possibly like the birth of an elite bat here.
So Tyler, I think with someone who's hitting as well as Judge is, you really can't be, you can't hedge and get him. If you were so motivated, you had to have Judge, how high are you going? What kind of bid are you placing? And you know, feel free to use names or maybe a ranking. What do you think Aaron Judge is in your mind?
So I own Judge in precisely one league, and I am. If you'll bear with me for a minute, I am going to look at the players who in this format are scored similar to him and tell you the names that I would accept. While I'm stalling for that, though, I think a question about Judge that I've got for you guys who paid more attention to the Yankee system, the farm, than I did. It seems like the question about Judge was like, would his power translate to game power, which is always that kind of question with, you know, really, really obviously strong guys who might have some holes. What I wonder is, like, do you feel like there's a risk that he'll be figured out, or are you guys seeing that, like, he's showing that he can adjust and stay like this for a consistent amount of time?
I guess from my point of view, what you like to see about Judge besides the results is the pitches he's laying off, especially, you know, it's night and day as it relates to last year, especially the slider just off the plate away. Pitchers continue to try to tempt him with that pitch, and I've seen him whiff at that pitch, but more often than not, he's spitting on it. And that pitch recognition, to me, that's the level up that we've seen in his skills this year, is the ability to lay off that pitch. And he's really, I mean, he's taking his walks. He's walking 14.5% of the time, which it would be his highest rate at any level since his first taste of high A in 2014. So that's what the plate discipline is what gives me optimism that this is a new Aaron Judge. And yeah, he's still going to strike out. I mean, he's at 26% of the time. He's still going to strike out a good bit just because of how tall he is. But I'm really impressed with the gains he's made in terms of plate discipline.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that, I'd say that really the name of the game for Judge this year was him actually adjusting. When he broke into the league last year, striking out almost half the time, it seemed like he was pretty much just flailing wildly up there. And there's a similar trend going back down in his minor league days. A lot of the time he'd struggle upon first hitting the level. So I think what you see here is him getting there and then adjusting rather than pitches adjusting to him. So I think you'll see that little battle back and forth between him and pitchers, especially when you're dealing with a guy that has such a large strike zone. But just the ability that he's been able to lay off pitches outside and has just been really impressive. So yep. I can see he's an athletic enough guy that he could keep doing that.
We'll talk a little bit about Eric Thames in a bit, and I just wanted to note that Judge's swing percentage out on balls outside the strike zone and his swinging strike rate, it's not far behind Eric Thames, who's been really praised for his incredible plate discipline with the power.
All right,
I think it's also worth
thank you guys for letting me stall yep. effectively, because actually Thames is one of those names that I was thinking. I'm not going to get into the details of the league where I own Judge, but looking at the hitters that are have put up comparable value to date in this league, I can't imagine trading him for another outfielder at this stage. Like, unless you can get Harper or Trout, which would be insane. Why would anyone trade you Harper or Trout for Aaron Judge? There's the other players that I'm seeing, who are coming close in the outfield. They're just if I'm contending, then I'd rather have Judge because he's got flashier tools. And if I'm not contending and I'm rebuilding, Judge is a lot younger than a lot of the guys who are racing up leaderboards. That said, I do think that there's a possibility that, if the team who owns Judge has a lot of other outfield options and is weak in another area, then a similarly...
Names! Give us names!
Yeah, Sano, maybe, like a Sano type, maybe a Lindor if you've got options. I think that, making an offer like that seems insane right now, but it might not be if he makes the difference for you. As far as pitching, I feel like the Judge owner is going to hold out for as much as possible. And so you have to be able to give them somebody maybe you can give a Carlos Carrasco and get an Aaron Judge back. But I don't know that I would take that deal if it was offered to me. Am I crazy? Am I completely overvaluing him?
No, I don't.
I mean, I agree. If you look at if you look at last year, somebody like Gary Sanchez, when he was going on that kind of run, it's like, who would you trade him for? I don't know. When you're hitting that well, there's no reason to move a guy. So it's kind of it's hard to find a trade partner there.
Yeah. So, I think philosophically, I would just literally never trade for an Aaron Judge or an Eric Thames in the middle of their hot streak. It's insane to me to buy.
Finding a partner is impossible.
What's the highest possible price? Especially in April when the season is so long, so much will change. If it's July and he's a difference maker for a contending team, then you pay what you need to, and you pay top prospects, maybe multiple ones.
Okay, so let's wrap Aaron Judge with this specific question to you because you do own him. Would you take you would not take Stanton or Springer?
Look, if Judge is doing this, that's what I would want Stanton to be doing. So why wouldn't I just keep Judge doing it?
But would you keep Springer? Or would you take Springer for him? I'd take Springer over Judge any day.
Yeah. In my mind, Springer is behind outfielders who maybe for you guys he's ahead of. I would definitely consider it. But I also feel like no one owns Aaron Judge as their best outfielder. Or maybe he's their best outfielder right now, but he wasn't heading into the season.
Would you trade Judge for Max Scherzer?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you offered me Max Scherzer, if you offered me Chris Sale, I would accept. I wouldn't look back.
Okay. So it sounds like we're saying that Aaron Judge is somewhere in that 30 range overall.
Yeah, probably. And and if he finishes at 60, then I'll feel great having traded him. And if he finishes at 10, I'll feel like an idiot.
Okay.
I'd probably call him a solid outfield two, but nothing higher for right now.
Yeah, I mean, you're obviously not going to get him for an outfield two. You basically have to be in or out to kind of a binary thing with Aaron Judge. There's no hedging. And I think that's perhaps less true with the next guy, Eric Thames. He's been equally impressive. But the fact that he's 30 years old, the fact that he is still coming over from professional baseball in Korea that maybe some people are skeptical of, I think Thames is available. So So I started with you, Ben, last time. Tyler, what are you seeing from Thames, and what do you expect the rest of the year?
I don't expect this to be the pace, but I don't really see why it stops. Like, I don't know what in his profile is going to, like, that the league's going to catch up on, because, like you said, he's showing, like, he's got plate discipline. He's figured that he's very selective. And when he's hitting it hard. And his division isn't going to give him that much of a challenge outside of the Cubs. So I think, you know, the biggest risk with Thames is that he is on a rebuilding team that is starting out very hot, and that won't last. I don't think the Brewers are as good as they were in April, and so the counting stats will start to slide as, you know, he's, you know, hitting home runs, but maybe not driving anyone in or being walked. I mean, that to me is the risk for this year. And I think, you know, you hit on the fact he's old, he's older, and he's got a lot of risk. So I think the smart play is to, you know, assume that Thames will continue to be productive and a productive first baseman for, like, just in any capacity, like that can make him a top 10 first baseman, no problem.
Yeah. So Ben, I'm gonna give you some first base names. You tell me when to stop, because you would not trade Eric Thames for the player, okay? So first up, Carlos Santana. Should I keep going, or you take Santana?
I'd probably take Thames.
Okay. Thames or Chris Davis?
Davis. I'd go Davis. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm not out on Thames, but I don't believe that any of this was that legit. So I just see too many red flags to, with the age, and just like he's slow, like as amazing as he was over the past month, he's not quite as amazing right now. So, I mean, obviously you can't discount what he's done, but you also have to look at what he's, the past five or so games. He's not as hot. And there's also, I see a risk that maybe he's never that good again. He's never close to that good again. So, yeah, I take Davis over him.
I feel like everything you just said about Thames, like Davis has all of those red flags and maybe more.
Well, Davis has a track record of performing, though.
That's true.
Yeah, and Thames doesn't. I mean, you can't take away what he did in Korea, but still.
But, like, I mean, if Davis has a 2014 style season where he hits, you know, maybe he gets to 30 home runs, but he's hitting at 200, like, I feel like that's the risk, and I feel like Thames, at least with what he's banked, is going to hit more home runs. I don't necessarily believe that Davis is going to bottom out, but
yeah. Well,
I take Thames.
Yeah, what I found interesting about Thames is that if you're a projection guy, as I am, at least as to start my frame of reference, beginning of each off season, he was right there with Springer in my OBP league. I think he was like right behind him. So I think a lot of us saw that and figured that it was just translation noise coming over from KBO, where maybe those projections aren't quite as accurate. But in fact, they were not accurate. They were light on him. So I think I'm a little bit higher on Thames, just because I don't really see the red flags from a performance perspective. You know, if you worry about five games, you might worry about Bryce Harper, who is, you know, gone from otherworldly to just regular type good. I think I would take him over Chris, certainly over Chris Davis. I'd take him over Hanley, E5, Abreu, and Will Myers is where I start to scratch my head a little bit. But anyway, we'll move on to another guy after a hot start that I think many of us left for dead, which I believe makes him a fantasy zombie, Ryan Zimmerman, who at 32 years old is having a career renaissance right now. Zimmerman's fascinating to me because last year he was seventh in Major League Baseball, depending on how you set the minimum samples, in exit velocity, but he was hitting it into the ground too much. This year he's third in barrels per plate appearance. Barrels is that ideal combination of exit velocity and launch angle. Aaron Judge, of course, is first. Ryan Zimmerman is third. So guys, what are you making of Ryan Zimmerman? Is this real as long as he can stay healthy? And I'll start with Ben.
You know, I mean, obviously a .427 batting average isn't real, but I mean, if he stays healthy, he can keep hitting as a elite third baseman. I mean, last year he was pretty awful, but he was also hurt for a lot of the year. And then there's also that weird discrepancy between exit velocity, launch angle, and results. And he also suffered some bad ball luck. So I think if you look at what he's been doing this year, I don't think, considering his talent level and how good he used to be, it's not outlandish to say that he could keep it up.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a tough one, Ryan Zimmerman, because on the one hand, I do think that it's very plausible that he's made some real adjustments, especially as a teammate of Murphy, who's a known launch angle adopter. But the health, Tyler, what do you think? Does the combination of the health and the poor performance last year make him a sell high?
Honestly, those things to me make me wonder, like, who was owning him to sell him? I picked him up off the waiver wire in more than one league, and I'm not confident that I'm going to be able to sell him for, for a value that I would want to get back based on what I hope he could do if I keep him. So that's the challenge with a player like him. But I mean, if you own him and you're not going to contend this year, or if you're even on the bubble, I would absolutely sell him, because you're probably not going to get that mix of like early season optimism among teams who think they can make a push, and the the exciting story that he represents, again, from a Ryan Zimmerman. Like, he's, and I think he's the kind of player that if you are going to make the push, that he's acquirable. And as a utility player, or as a corner infielder, he's almost certainly a better option than a lot of the other guys you would be playing there, at least while he's healthy, at least for the next month and a half.
So one last hot guy before we move on to some of the Debbie Downer performances across the league. That's Miguel Sano. In 2015, he looked like Babe Ruth. Last year, he disappointed a lot of us, both due to poor health and also the batting average came crashing down. And this offseason, I saw a lot of people calling him basically Todd Frazier without the steals, which I thought was a little harsh. Hopefully you looked at Brett's top 500, because he did keep the faith and ranked him 31st overall. But right now he has a 208 WRC+. Ben, what do you think the real Sano is? He's still only 23 years old, 24 in a few days. Is he an elite masher, or is this maybe another opportunity to sell high?
I'm buying here. We know that he's always had that kind of power, and now he's making contact. And obviously, if you look, his strikeouts are still a little bit high, but he's also walking at a ridiculous clip. So I think if he can find a balance in between those two, continue crushing balls, I see a guy that can definitely be an elite third baseman or DH, first baseman, wherever he ends up in the future.
Tyler, you agree? Do you consider him an elite first baseman right now?
It's weird that right now, like this actual moment, first base is kind of weirdly deep. so I guess I would. I mean, he's young, and he's been. This is what everyone wanted him to be, and since he is doing it, there is not really a good reason to say that it's not real. Because I mean, I think, you know, we'll talk about this maybe when we talk about his teammate Buxton in a bit. Like, we've seen what the lows are like, and now we're seeing what the highs are like. And I think, you know, he might have periods of the low, but he's capable of doing this. He's going to do this again. Whether he sustains it for the whole season, I think that's what's going to make him elite. And so I don't necessarily think he's, you know, going to be elite every year for the next 3 or 4 years, but I think over a longer span of time, I would not be surprised at all if he's, you know, consistently a top five top five at that position, or whatever position he qualifies for.
You know, one of the stats I might take a closer look at in the offseason are some of the plate discipline stats. They tend to normalize more quickly, so they're meaningful more quickly than most stats. Looking at last year, Sano actually cut his swinging strike rate and improved his contact rate. So there were signs of potential breakout. He's since cut those numbers, or improved those numbers even more. So now moving on to some of the sad sacks from this year. Let's start with the pitcher injuries and maybe a little bit of advice for those who lost Noah Syndergaard or Madison Bumgarner. And then maybe if you're a vulture and you're maybe looking towards next season, whether you have any concerns about making that investment in those two injured pitchers. So Tyler, you're one of those vultures in one of your leagues. Why don't you tell us about your attempts to acquire Madison Bumgarner?
Yeah, I'm a vulture in every league. If you've listened to this podcast, you know that recently injured pitchers are like, you know, if I've got a DL spot, I want your best recently injured pitcher. So in an 18-team league, I am not contending, and I had been in the past, so I've got an old team of veterans, and I'm trying to get Bumgarner. My first attempt was Encarnacion for Bumgarner, which got laughed down immediately, which I felt was a little harsh and not countered. So I'm kind of rethinking, I'm like licking my wounds and rethinking my strategy. But I am, I'm looking at Bumgarner, and I, as the person who doesn't own him, I'm seeing all the red flags that I would use to wave in someone's face to say, this is why you should trade him to me. Like, you know, it's a shoulder injury. Those are scary as hell. And he's an idiot who was riding a dirt bike and lives in a weird town in North Carolina where everyone's named Madison. So he's probably going to injure his shoulder again on another dirt bike later. All that said, he's probably the most acquirable ace right now. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but I think, you know, he's probably the one that you can go out and get most likely. If I were to offer, let's say, I'm looking, Tom, because you, I think, own Bumgarner on your DL.
I own Bumgarner in a league where I'm contending. I'm in first place, and so I would be the kind of guy that you would expect to maybe be willing to sell. And I have to tell you, I'm really not. Like the discount that I'm willing to take on him is very small. Part of that is that I feel like, you know, I've been able to patch the rotation together. Like, for example, if, like, Alex Wood has been good. But part of it is also that I find pitching is just so damn hard to find reliable players. And it's so hard to analyze. And it's not hard to analyze that Madison Bumgarner is really effing good. And so I want to stick with the guy that I know to be amazing.
Okay, so I want to do a little thought experiment with you then. I agree. Everything you just said makes a lot of sense. I think a one-for-one trade for a guy like Bumgarner, even when he's on the DL, becomes very hard because you're valuing the player. Both sides are going to value the player very differently. But I think he's a perfect candidate for, like, you know, you won't trade me Bumgarner straight up, but if I offered you... if I offered you Jameson Taillon and
that next guy has to be better than Taillon for me to want to do that.
McCullers.
No, I wouldn't do it. Because Taillon in particular, you know, I don't think he has a third pitch. I mean, he seems like a rich man's Kevin Gausman. So when things are going well, it looks nice because he throws real hard and he's got a good second pitch. But there's that risk that he just never really expands on what he is right now, which is, you know, like a solid strikeout guy with an ERA in mid to high threes.
Okay. So let's say, so what is that the right strategy though? If I wanted to get Bumgarner from you, is going younger and like potential the right way to try to get him at like a package that is potential, or would you hold no matter what?
No, I'm not dogmatic about it. I would sell him. I think it's actually the opposite, where Max Scherzer would be the most tempting for me, because I described, you know, how obviously good Madison Bumgarner is. Scherzer is so obviously good that's where I would be tempted. I think the more interesting vulture case is actually Starling Marte. Because I think that there's going to be enough concern about, well, how much of his production had to do with his PEDs, He's now 28. You know, his speed declines quickly. Is this still an elite asset? So Ben, do you think is Starling Marte someone that you'd be more willing to move if you had him? And on the flip side, is he someone you'd want to be circling as a vulture if you're maybe out of it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to look at both sides of the table here. And that, I mean, obviously Marte, he was probably a borderline first round pick this year. Really obvious elite outfield one. I mean, I took him really high in my draft and I'm not thrilled about it now, but he's a guy that before this year, you couldn't doubt that he was one of the best outfielders in the game. And if you look at PEDs, a lot of the guys that get busted for it come back just as strong. So I'm not as worried, I'd say, about him losing production from that, especially when he's not a guy that needs a lot of power to succeed. That being said, he is a guy that doesn't have the best skill set when it comes to aging, and he's already 28 years old and is going to lose the majority of 2017. So I'm not like feeling strong on either side. I mean, I perfectly understand if you want to trade for him right now, pick a guy up like that that could be a strong outfield one for a few years. But at the same time, trading him is not absurd.
Yeah. What about Noah Syndergaard? Is there anything about his kind of injury that gives you pause about his ability to resume being an elite, you know, top 1 to 3 starting pitcher in 3 months when we think he'll be back?
Yeah, he's another tough case. Oh, okay.
I feel like everything you just said applies way more to Bumgarner than it does to Syndergaard. I think Syndergaard's timetable for return is a question mark right now, but I would not be shocked if he's back before Bumgarner, and I would not be shocked if based on the injuries that they had, like a shoulder injury is a lot scarier to me than, you know, if Syndergaard was having Tommy John, I feel like a shoulder injury carries with it so many question marks that that's scarier to me. I think both of them are more likely than not to continue being great. But I would be way more scared of Bumgarner than I would be of Syndergaard right now.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I mean, shoulders petrify me. The guy, I mean, obviously Bumgarner's not getting any kind of rotator cuff surgery or Lehman surgery, but anything near the shoulder, I mean, the odds of them coming back the same way they used to be is tiny. So I'd be more comfortable trading for Syndergaard right now, especially given his age.
Yep. I think you're discounting the fact that Madison Bumgarner is not human a little bit, but point taken.
Syndergaard's literally a god, so I don't know what you mean by that.
That is true. Another bummer of an April that was kind of buoyed by some homers and steals is Jonathan Villar. He's a guy that I had made a panic trade to shed myself of. I made a big bet, as I often do. I'm the kind of guy that will buy Aaron Judge in this kind of hot streak. And so I bought Jonathan Villar this offseason for a lot of pitching. I think it was Tanaka, Wade Davis, and Familia. So not catastrophic, but certainly, you know, quite an investment. And I just was really bothered by what I saw, both from his performance, but also the context. The performance, you know, we can all see that the strikeouts spiked. But even more than that, the fact that the Brewers are competent and have such quality hitters behind him and Thames and Braun, I just felt like the green light might be yellow, and so I wanted to bail, and I did. So wondering if you what you guys think of that move to bail, or if it was a little too soon.
I think it was probably too soon given what you gave up to get him. And I mean, I know that you're a very aggressive trader, so that, you know, it might just be you're moving pieces like that constantly. But when you trade for a player's potential, I think that's when if you're going to trade away that player, and unless you're getting a piece that's, you know, making you better in a clear area of need, that, you know, it comes out in the wash, then I think you owe it to your past self to hold on to the player until you can at least get comparable value to the package that you gave up, you know, had you kept it. And I think maybe that's true with Familia not being a lock for a closer, where he might have seemed like that when you traded him away. But I feel like that's the part of this that if you said you owned Villar and you'd bought him low, then the investment is a lot lower. But
yeah,
I don't know how you'd justify it unless you tell me that your return was
no the return Tanaka. The return was actually a little sketchy too. I got Yasiel Puig on the I really like his plate discipline numbers, and I think he's putting the ball in the air a little bit more this year. His soft contact is a career low. His swinging strike rate is a career low. So even though the results haven't been there, I like what he's doing. And then I also got Tim Anderson. I guess the way I was thinking it, looking at it, I thought it was two buy lows where I felt like Puig was safe to be like a reasonably productive player. And Villar, I mean, I really worry about him totally turning into a pumpkin, because, I mean, he wasn't a good baseball player before last year, really. I mean, there's some BABIP inflated periods of success, but especially factoring in defense. Ben, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have a history with Villar and a lot of buying and selling of him. So, I mean, I'm a little bit testy with him, but I think, I mean, I'm going to choose pretty arbitrary endpoints here, but if you look at his projection from the start of the year to April 19th, in 70 plate appearances, he was hitting 138 with a near 40% strikeout rate. If you go from April 20th to present time, that's 55 plate appearances. He's hitting 306 with a 370 on-base percentage, 23% strikeout rate. So that doesn't mean that he's fine now, but I think that makes me a lot more confident that his start to the season was just really ugly, but is behind him.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So thanks for making me feel terrible about myself, guys. I'm going to go kill myself.
Well, I will say, I want to ask you a question. Would you have traded Tanaka, Davis, and Familia for Puig and Anderson?
No. And I think about that 7 times per day, every day.
Especially because you have Bumgarner injured.
Every single day. I'm human, so I think about those things all the time, but you got to fight. If you're a fantasy owner, you have to fight the urge to think about what did I trade. You have to do whatever you think is best from the information we have today instead of looking back. I mean, we all know about the sunk cost fallacy, and that's
yeah, the way I try. I think that's true, and I think I think you're right to approach it that way, but I also I mean, you trade a lot more aggressively than I do. And so I wonder if, for you, it's just a matter of, well, there's going to be another deal you're going to win down the line. So
yeah,
it's fine.
I think about my wins to help. I literally lose sleep over this stuff. And so I was thinking about, like, I just got Blake Snell for these two high school bats. And I was just like, that was great. That was great. At least I can fall back on the two high school bats for Blake Snell.
Well, let's I got a good transition. That to one of the players we wanted to talk about. In the offseason, I needed to get younger and needed to shed some salary in this league, so I traded Kluber. I traded Kluber and Carrasco for a package that was included McCullers and a couple other pieces, and was headlined by Byron Buxton.
Yep, the Buxton. Yeah.
I feel good that Kluber, I mean, I don't feel good because Kluber was a lifesaver for me in this league, and I loved him, and I wish him the best in life. I feel okay knowing that I would not be getting value from him for a while right now, but I was buying on Buxton in a way that I did not need to, I feel like, I've tried to convince myself that I'll feel good about this trade someday, and I'm not sure I can do it.
Yeah, I offered Kluber for Buxton in the offseason and was disappointed that it was rejected. And well, now I'm not exactly sure how I feel because Kluber has been bad and on the DL. But man, I didn't see Byron Buxton has a career worst swinging strike rate by far. He's a career worst contact rate by far. I don't think you can beat yourself up over this too much if you're a dynasty owner. There was going to be risk. But Ben, did you think that this was even a possibility? 43 WRC plus.
I mean, Yeah, I mean, God, I don't know. Buxton, he's one of those guys that if I own him right now, I'm just going to put my hands in the air and just watch, see what happens. Probably just watch his defensive highlights over and over and hope he gets better. Because, I mean, he's still only 23. I mean, and he showed a resurgence at the end of last year. So I'm probably, I don't know. I wouldn't buy him right now, but I wouldn't sell him just given his huge upside. So I didn't expect this. I thought he was going to start the season pretty well. So it's disappointing, but he's just got that talent that I can't be trading him away.
No, you can't trade him. You cannot trade him.
No, absolutely not. I wouldn't definitely not.
No, God no. But I wouldn't be buying him either. I'd probably avoid that too.
So Tyler, if you have Buxton and you're a contender, what kind of salvage value do you think is reasonable? I mean, we all three of us agreed he's not someone you should be selling. But you know, if you're in a unique spot where you know you're maybe in first or second place and you flags fly forever, so screw it. Like what do you think is reasonable?
A closer. I would sell him for a closer.
And is that like a Kimbrel closer or
yeah, if the Kimbrel owner will give it, yeah, I mean that level. Like not an elite closer, but someone who is not on the bubble. Yeah, I think that's the, like, if I'm a contender, Buxton is the kind of player that I would flip for the person who's going to give me the most value. And, that's, you know, that's almost always a closer at this point. Like this is, that's, I don't know. The best one I could go, I'd go for the best closer I feel like I could get for him. And then I just keep offering him to, for whatever I could get. And then I'd feel bad when he, you know, in June, steals 20 bases or something.
I think
I'm looking at my roster in this league where I own Buxton, and I also own Chris Herman, who you might not know is a catcher in Arizona, and he has outproduced Buxton in this league for my team.
Yeah, you could play that game for days. I think in points leagues, he just recently became, you know, went above zero for the season.
That's true. So, he's worth 15 points in this point.
Congratulations, Byron Buxton. I think my biggest
same as Adam Conley.
My biggest disappointment on the year is that Trevor Story is not doing better, because I would have loved to have made fun of Ben for ranking Tulowitzki above him.
I would never celebrate a player doing terribly, but I mean, I'm celebrating it a little bit right now. I'll be honest. I'm sure he'll turn it around. I'm sure he will. But I mean, right now I don't feel so sad about ranking Story. I think I had him at 12th in Dynasty shortstop rankings, and that maybe people would still put him higher. But I'm giving myself a tiny pat on the back for now.
Yeah, don't pat too hard, because Troy Tulowitzki is a guy above him. we'll end on a more positive note by talking about first Cody Bellinger, and then just checking in if there's any. Minor league performances that you guys have taken notice on. So Bellinger, I think we all knew that the power was there, but we weren't quite sure how he would fit into this, not a loaded Dodgers lineup, but certainly a lineup that had, you know, start worthy bodies at every position. So putting your redraft hats on, is he up for good? They're finding space for him at first base. And regardless, what are you encouraged by in the early going from Bellinger? So I'm not sure if either of you guys are Bellinger owners. I won't direct it to anybody to start, but feel free to jump in and talk over each other awkwardly.
Once again, I am an owner. I named all the players when we were throwing out names that I owned and have some thoughts on, because it's really hard for me to keep track of all the players I don't own during the season. But I don't have any confidence that he's up for good. I think that he's forced the question more than I think probably the Dodgers wanted him to. I think all it'll take is a little bit of a slip back, and they've got no reason not to send him down. That's probably the smart move on their part, in terms of both his long-term success and their team success. So he should be getting at bats more regularly. And if he's on the bench on the Dodgers, he's not doing that. So I don't have confidence that he's up for good. I do have confidence that he's the kind of player that they'll try to figure out a way to get him to play. So he will always be the first option that comes back when they've got, and you know, maybe a corner or an outfield spot. And so I'm encouraged that he's sort of turned himself around from his first couple games, and he's looking like what you want a young player to look like without necessarily looking like an Aaron Judge-esque superstar. And that's the sort of thing I want to see from a player. I want to see that there's no like obvious, they can't actually be a major leaguer that you see with, you know, some prospects who are really highly touted and then just, for whatever reason, come up and get figured out very quickly. That has not been the case with him. He's already shown some ability to adjust, and that'll be a give and take. I want to see that. I want to see that he will play, and I want to have a spot for him on my bench because I do not expect that he will play more than 100 games this season. I think that's probably high.
So, Ben, noting that Bellinger had 7 steals in the minors before he was called up, and maybe this is a guy that has some sneaky wheels. The athleticism has always been a strong point for him. Is Bellinger a top 100 overall fantasy asset for you today?
Not yet. I mean, first baseman, I mean, I guess you can call him an outfielder too, but I mean, primarily first baseman that are in the minor leagues have a ton of risk, and they really have to mash, and I mean, Bellinger's done that, but I'm not calling him top 100 just yet. He's pretty close, and I mean, he's borderline. He's really borderline right now, I think. And he's definitely a stronger fantasy player right now than he would be a real-life player, and I think that adds to some value for him. But until he can really come up and show that he can hit for a while, I'm not completely going to buy him as a top 100 asset.
Okay. So I wanted to wrap by calling out the minor leaguers that have caught our eye, for better or for worse. I'll start so I can give you guys a chance to dig on your end. Two guys I wanted to flag. One's J.P. Crawford. He's someone that I've always really liked and been an apologist for, because even when the stats didn't jump out at you, the plate discipline numbers were always good or at least tolerable. Even last year, he walked 11% of the time. This year, he is walking, but he's a 29 WRC+. And to me, I'm not necessarily out on him, but it does, when you see struggles over 100 plate appearances at AAA like this for a guy who is, you know, a top 10 prospect in some people's minds, it does dim the star. And maybe lowers my expectations. You know, he may be more Orlando Arcia than something better than Orlando Arcia. The other guy I wanted to call out as kind of a pop-up guy that I have my eye on, not someone you need to run out and add, but that's Monty Harrison on the Brewers. The reason is that he hasn't really produced in the past, so he will probably be available in your league. But he's the kind of pop-up guy, maybe similar to like a Travis Demerite, who if it all comes together, the tools are very fantasy friendly. People love the athleticism, and so he has a chance to be an impact player that you can add for free. So I would just at minimum keep my eye on him. You guys know your leagues better than we do as far as how deep they go and whether it's time to pick him up. But take a look and continue to monitor him. Which one of you guys feels like you're ready to roll with your player first?
Yeah, I'll go for it. One guy that I had my eye on that has been letting it up right now early on is Alex Jackson. I guess you could call him a fantasy zombie while still being a prospect. He was a sixth overall pick for the Mariners, was pretty awful for a while, got traded to the Braves, is having a renaissance there. They brought him back from the outfield to the catching behind the plate, and all of a sudden he has 7 home runs in 25 games and is like actually showing some hitting ability. Still not walking, but I mean, he's catching, which makes him automatically more attractive to fantasy owners I wouldn't say that, but I mean, it does take some pressure off his bat. So I mean, I'm not banking on him going back to the guy that the Mariners thought could be just like one of the better outfielders in baseball when they draft him in 6th overall. But this is a guy that has the pedigree, has a ton of power, and could be a catcher now. So I think he's really interesting to keep an eye on at the very least.
That's a good one. He had 120 WRC+ last year, so it's not like he was a total nightmare a year ago. But he definitely, he's broken out again.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, and then but then if you want to look at the negative side of things, there's Austin Meadows right now. I think not a ton has been made about it, right, because he's just such a good talent. But he's hitting right now, he's hitting 198 with a slugging percentage under 300 in AAA. And he's still a really young guy. He's only 22, has all the talent in the world. So I'm not too worried about him. But I'd probably give him say he's a good example of a guy that maybe you want to go out and say, hey, like to a fantasy owner in your league that might own him and make the pitch that he's hitting horribly and he's injury prone and all this stuff. And then try to grab a guy like that who has the upside to be one of the, to be an outfield one, outfield two.
That was nice of you to wait until the day after his birthday to bash him.
Yeah, right.
Oh, he's a year older than you thought he was too.
No, he turned 22. Nope, yesterday.
He's 22 now. 22 in one day. Yep.
Right. Yeah. You thought he was 21. No, he's actually 22.
He's at 22, and he was on tape saying.
I'm on top of it. We can go back and check instant replay.
We can have a separate podcast where we debate how old Ben said Austin Meadows was.
I wasn't listening because I was trying to look up names. Actually, I have one that I think I would buy, and that's Rhys Hoskins. I was on the record saying that the Phillies' first base situation was a lot more combustible than people thought it was. Oh,
combustible.
Yeah, combustible. And no.
Good try.
And so I think that that's definitely the case. And Hoskins was never one of the bigger name first base prospects. And, Ben, everything you said about first base prospects is definitely true. And I think that, Hoskins he's 24 in AAA, his first season in AAA, and he's off to a pretty good start, not necessarily like, lighting the world on fire, but, he's almost certainly going to have an opportunity this year, and I think that opportunity is going to be a lot sooner than maybe some of my fellow Phillies fans might want to think. So I think he's going to hit for power. He might come up and be what Tommy Joseph was last year, and then turn back into what Tommy Joseph has proven to be. I think that's what Tommy Joseph really is, and I think that's probably a trajectory that Hoskins wouldn't be mad at, because I don't know how much better than Joseph long term he is as an option, but in terms of right now as a stash, who could come up with a super two if the Phillies first base situation continues to be what it is. I think it's something that you could probably get him for not too much, because people don't pay a ton of attention to the performance of AAA first basemen in deep fantasy leagues where there's more exciting younger guys, and compared to what you might have to pay to get Dom Smith, who is also not as bad as I would make fun of Brett for saying, or I would have said to Brett, but anyway, as far as one that I'm feeling bad about, I can't say Buxton again because I already said that. This is not a prospect, so this doesn't count. This is a guy in the major leagues, but I made a play for Ryan Schimpf, and I think that he's eminently ownable. You could probably go out and get him in whatever league you're in right now for very little, and it would be exciting to do so because he's got a lot of power, but he also hits for nothing and is like 28 years old. So beware, guys that you didn't know who are on the San Diego Padres and have tools that look good, because they're all older than you think they are.
Okay, now I'm going to have...
If I could add one...
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, Schimpf, I don't know how to say his name, but he was a guy that I was looking at pretty closely during the Dynasty process, the rankings this offseason, and he's really intriguing with the power potential, especially at second base, but I think if you look at... maybe a comparison, Jed Jorko. Last year he hit 243, hit 30 home runs, and he was only 25th at second base on the ESPN Player Rater. So, I mean, if you're expecting Schimpf to do that, to hit 30-plus home runs and with a pretty bad batting average, he's really not going to be that valuable.
Yeah, yeah. I would recommend this doesn't necessarily apply to Schimpf, but Baseball Savant has some really cool tools for fantasy owners. If you go to the StatCast search on Baseball Savant – and then sort by at the bottom of the query and sort by XWOBA minus WOBA, which is that's expected WOBA minus actual WOBA. It's fun to see which guys, based on their batted ball profile, that's their exit velocity and launch angle, plus their walks, who has the biggest discrepancy. It's kind of like next level BABIP, and I really believe that a year from now this is what we'll be talking about instead of batting average and balls in play. The caveat is that it is biased against speed guys and in favor of slow guys. So for example, it will always think someone like Miggy Cabrera has been quote unquote unlucky, but that's in part because a lot of balls that he puts in play, other guys might beat out that he does not because he's so slow. And meanwhile, Billy Hamilton is the opposite. He usually has an expected WOBA below his actual WOBA. So it's a really interesting tool. Gary Sanchez and the couple of Yankee catchers, Kyle Higashioka and Gary Sanchez, are the most unlucky players in the majors this year based on a tiny sample. But there's a lot of really fun nuggets there. And one last nugget before we go, a little bit of trivia for you guys. Francisco Lindor leads shortstops with 7 home runs this year. Manny Machado and Trevor Story are tied for second with 6 with which shortstop? Can either of you guys guess who it is?
Cozart.
Nope. Ben, do you want to? I'll give you a hint.
No, I'm gonna embarrass myself. I'm not even gonna try.
He's in the American League East.
Daniel Robertson.
No. Ronald Torres.
Nope.
I'm gonna name all of the shortstops I know who are in the American League East.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Go ahead, keep going.
Bogarts.
Nope.
I'm gonna run out of them. Oh, who's playing for the Blue Jays right now? Tulowitzki.
Nope.
I don't have any idea. Just say
he plays in Florida.
Oh, crap.
That former guy, first round draft pick Tim, whose name yes. I almost said.
Tim Beckham has 6 home runs and a 263 ISO. I'm keeping my eye on him. I'm interested. He's got some pop, and I think he could keep that job.
What does it say about me that Daniel Robertson was the first Rays shortstop I thought of?
I know. I mean, that's kind of why I wanted to. That's why I wanted to toy with you guys, because I knew you'd have a million guesses. And you,
Daniel Robertson, has stolen at bats from Tim Beckham this year. Tim Beckham could have 7 home runs.
No more. That will not happen.
It was going to be Pete Cosmo.
That'll do it for episode 11. Thanks for listening, and guys, thanks for chatting with me this evening. And enjoy the rest of your nights.